Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market. A New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a place. Today, we'll be taking a closer look at Puerto Rico, discussing some of the amazing food, of course, but also some important current events affecting the U.S. territory. I'm joined by Dr. Melissa Fuster, Assistant Professor in Public Health and Nutrition from Brooklyn College. So, Melissa, thank you for joining us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you're from Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And so I'm going to, you're going to be my food expert. You're going to help me out. I've never been to Puerto Rico, actually. I hope to go really soon. But since I've never been there, like, explain to me, how would you describe Puerto Rican cuisine with someone who's like never had the experience?
I would start by saying that it's very delicious. It's also very flavorful, and it's flavorful without being hot. So we tend to think Latin American immediately go to Mexican food where you have that hot spiciness. But Puerto Rican food is spicy, but more into flavor. It can be filling, so a lot of fried foods, comforting food. The base of the diet is rice, white rice, and beans, red beans. And meat is also very important. Traditionally, we think about pork, but also chicken, beef. Another very important piece of the cuisine is plantains. So things like tostones, mofongo. For those of you who have gone to a Puerto Rican restaurant, that's the mashed plantains with chicharrón and garlics. It's very, very good. At the same time, if you think of traditional, I mean, we have to define what is traditional and when. So for me, it's, again, the rice, the beans, the steaks, bistec, as we call it. But then if you ask for the time of my grandparents, it was more salted codfish, what we call viandas, that are a variety of root crops like yuca and things like that. And now, so those are the traditional influences, Spanish, Taino influences, and also African influence coming into play. But now, as we became part of the U.S., you also have a big influx of fast foods. And it's very interesting to see some mixtures of traditional dishes interpreted by, say, McDonald's or KFC.
What does that look like, actually, in reality?
So, for example, you might go into KFC and get, instead of fries, rice and beans. They don't taste that good, but they're there.
Right. And you mentioned the Spanish influence, the African influence. So it seems like there's like that influence that over time, over history, but there's also these local ingredients like plantain and yuca. So, and those two kind of come together to form what Puerto Rican cuisine is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what about, what besides the U.S. influence, what accounts for the disparity between your generation and, as you mentioned, your grandparents' generation? Is it just fast food or is there something else at play?
I think even though we try to think of tradition as something that stays in time, it changes. So in the time of my grandparents, maybe meat was not so much available as it is now. So people went to more salted codfish, is something that doesn't require refrigeration. So it's easy, you just have it there, and when you want to use it, you just desalt it and use it. Versus now that we do have greater access to meat, actually, If you have a meal without meat in Puerto Rico, it's not considered a meal. So it's very, very important at this point. And I do think now the scene is changing to include a very great influx of U.S.-based chains. But I should also say that it's not as bad as it sounds in that sense, because at the same time, we do have some culinary resurgence of great restaurants coming into the island, from chefs, even from New York-based chefs coming in to open very fancy, nice restaurants, to local chefs reinventing the cuisine, at times going back to some of those older time ingredients and bringing them back to the contemporary fine dining cuisine.
So what does the dining scene look like? So you have these chefs coming in and you're elevating a little bit. You have a little bit more of this like oak Puerto Rican cuisine, I guess. But then I'm assuming there's street food and there's probably a lot in the middle. So what does it look like when you go out for dinner?
You can eat at any time of day from 8 a.m. to 4 a.m. any type of food. So you do have, if you go around the street, you do have street vendors selling pork, chicken, those fried goods that here, if you know the Puerto Rican cuisine here, is called cuchifritos. We don't really call it that way in Puerto Rico, but here it's referred to as cuchifritos. So you have that is very cheap, very easy. And then in every place, every corner, you have fast foods. And they're even used as like if you're lost and you ask someone when you go to Puerto Rico, how do I get here? McDonald's is often used as a point of reference.
Uh-huh.
And it can be, oh, you pass the first McDonald's and the second McDonald's, you make a left.
Wow.
So that tells you the amount of fast foods. And also we are having an influx of, say, for example, the most recent one was Olive Garden. And these are things that people, I remember watching TV because we do get, of course, US-based television and seeing Olive Garden, but you cannot access it. So the first time I came to New York, of course, I went to the Olive Garden in Times Square because it was like, oh my God, there is.
And how did that go for you?
I mean, it was okay. It was the first excitement
I think
of
you're being
New
nice.
York. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know any better.
All right. Well, you mentioned pork a couple of times. As far as the diet in Puerto Rico, is pork kind of king as far as meat is concerned?
In the traditional imaginary, pork is very important. And you see it more, for example, in Christmas. Okay. Great Christmas traditional peasant-based dinner would be going into the backyard and we call it lechon a la vara, so a pork that you put a stick and then you cook it over a fire pit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's very, very important. But I think typically it's eaten more over Christmas, but you do also get like that mofongo mm-hmm. stuff with pork. But day-to-day, it might be more chicken or just beef.
Okay. And would you say that mofongo is like the national dish of Puerto Rico? Is there something else that's kind of like what Puerto Rico is known for?
I think mofongo can be one of those things that you can distinguish Puerto Rican cuisine from others. But yeah, there might be other things that people can tell you. Another one that I don't think we share with any other, like say Cuba or Dominican Republic, is the pastelón de amarillo. So that's, I don't like the translation, but the best way to explain it, it's a Puerto Rican lasagna, where instead of pasta, you have fried ripe plantains as layers, and then on between them, you have ground meat. And my mom, for example, I love the way she makes it. She put green beans with the meat and then covers it in cheese. So it's really, really good because you have the sweetness with the saltiness together.
Yeah, it sounds delicious. So what about like drinks and desserts? Like, are you drinking, like, what's the local thing that you would have with like every meal?
Well, unfortunately, we do drink a lot of soda.
We're going to get to that. I see a theme emerging here, and I know you, so we're gonna.
But if you, one traditional drink that was invented in Puerto Rico was the piña colada. That it was invented in a Spanish bartender that invented it, but it was in a hotel in Puerto Rico. And that's one that is, again, very, very unique. If you think, for example, of the Cuban mojito, then we have our piña colada. Mm-hmm. We, if you go out at night, what you might drink is, of course, a lot of beer because it's very hot. We have a national beer called Medalla, as in medal.
And rum production is big on the island.
Yes.
And important to the economy, I imagine.
Yes, we do have...
Speaking of pina coladas.
Yes. We have the Don Q, that's a Puerto Rican-based brand. People also know Bacardi, but if you know, that's a Cuban company that moved to the island. And the one that is least known in the U.S., but I think is the best, is Ron Barrilito, that you can get it in the airport and in some places in the U.S., but it is very, very good.
Is it like smaller, more like artisanal type of rum, or?
It is on the smaller production because it's not as widely distributed as Don Q or Bacardi. Mm-hmm. And actually, we also have our own moonshine that we call Pitorro. And that has been kind of an illegal production. And that's another thing over Christmas that we drink along with Coquito. That's the other one. And Pitorro lately, I think from maybe 2 years from ago, we are seeing more production. For example, there is a distillery in the Bronx here that produces Pitorro. Although we can get into the argument whether it should be called Pitorro because it's not.
Oh, goodness. I think I'll stay out of that fray.
I have a friend that he works on that research, and it's contested whether it should be. But it's how people know it.
And so what about people here in the U.S., like, if they want to learn more about Puerto Rican cuisine, what resources are out there as far as, like, books or blogs? Or, like, what's the best way to kind of start out?
Eating it. I mean, There are a lot of good Puerto Rican restaurants. It's actually interesting. Something that I'm researching right now is that I'm being in New York for the past 2 years, and even though we have the biggest concentration of Puerto Ricans in the U.S., even though it's growing in Florida, we don't see a lot of Puerto Rican restaurants in the dining scene, although they exist. But, you know, just give it a try. And there are very good restaurants in other places. For example, when I lived in Boston, there is one that's called Casa B that it's a nice mixture of fancy tapas with Colombian cuisine coming together. So just give it a try.
All right, before we take a break, we're going to move into more current events in the second half of the show. But I know your interest and your research, obviously, is in public health and nutrition. And you mentioned several times the fast food phenomenon in Puerto Rico and sodas and things like that. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about your thoughts and your feelings and your experiences in Puerto Rico with those kind of cultural interlopers, I should say.
There are a lot of fast foods, and soda is very big. Coca-Cola has been very good about promoting soda consumption. One thing, for example, that they did recently when I went last Christmas is that, you know, I don't know if people know that Coca-Cola has, like, the names of people. So they did a study.
It's like drink a Coke with.
Exactly. Yeah. So they did a study in Puerto Rico, and they put out cans and bottles with the most common last names. So when I went to my family celebration, you could see Los Rodriguez, and then you bought like a bunch of 2 liters because they had your last name. So it's, you know, that promotion have really worked, and it's everywhere, and you can get it at any time. The times I eat a fast food is when I go to Puerto Rico, especially if you go out till late at night and it's open, you go in and you eat it.
But what's the public health, what are the consequences that it's having on the public health of Puerto Ricans?
We do have a high rate of, I don't know, I don't have the statistics with me right now, but I know the obesity rate is fairly high. I would be confident that if not the highest in the U.S., it's almost there. A lot of childhood obesity issues, diabetes is very high. But it's not only, even though I focus on diet, we also have to remember the physical activity side. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of walking. And if you try, I mean, coming from New York, of course, you want to go and walk everywhere. But if the sidewalks are not good, or if there's a car parked in the middle of the... So it's not that conducive to walking. And physical activity in your daily life is sometimes not possible.
Well, and also speaking on the physical side, I feel like with this influx of fast food, are people cooking less at home?
People are busier. Mm-hmm. I think that the same thing you see in the U.S. So, and again, it's so easy. If you're a mother coming out of work and you're picking your kids from school and you pass by X fast food chain through the car window, you just go. Mm-hmm. So it might be also a little bit of that as well.
Is there a concern that if people are cooking less at home and have less time, that culinary traditions may or may not be lost over time?
That is a good question, but I still think that even though people would go to these fast foods, another thing that happened, for example, if you go on a Sunday, people travel from, I'm from San Juan, the capital, and you would go to different towns in the island to, for example, get pork or get more of that traditional. So people still seek that. And if you go through lunchtime and you go to those little restaurants, they are full. So people they're eating a lot. So it's not only those chains, but also the other traditional foods.
Good. All right. Well, before we take a quick break, one last question. And I know we're talking about Puerto Rico, but I just have to ask. I'm planning a trip to Cuba right now. And literally, I'm not even exaggerating. Every single person I talk to when I mention it, they're like, oh, yeah, you have to go before Starbucks moves in, or you have to go before McDonald's gets there. Do you think the same thing that happened in Puerto Rico with the influx of foreign chains coming in is going to happen in Cuba?
I don't know. Cuba, I've been, mm-hmm. and I think it, you know, we think that Cuba is closed, but it's not really closed. They do have the influx of every other country except the U.S. So I don't know if you will see chains. I mean, when you go, there are, for example, I remember seeing a Benetton store, so there might be some familiar places. But I don't know if it will become as prevalent as you see in Puerto Rico because of the traditions that maybe they have there of that resistance. I mean, you never know.
Yeah.
I think they are contesting what will happen as Cuba keeps opening, especially to the U.S.
We'll just have to wait and see, I guess. Yes. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be continuing my conversation with Melissa Fuster, and we'll be talking about some current events in Puerto Rico.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, this is Dave Arnold from Cooking Issues, and I'm here to talk to you about the Museum of Food and Drink, which is finally getting a brick-and-mortar space right here in Brooklyn, New York. So the Museum of Food and Drink is opening the MOFAD Lab, our first laboratory and gallery space, where we will be putting on an exhibition called Making It or Faking It, the history of the flavor industry. And it tackles a very important topic, which is how the food system got to be the way it is now as a result of the intervention of the flavor industry, how that happened. Get your tickets at tickets.mofad.org to come see the first exhibit ever of the Museum of Food and Drink at the MOFAD Lab, brought to you by Infinity on 62 Bayard Street.
All right, we are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you're listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I am talking to Dr. Melissa Fuster, Assistant Professor in Public Health and Nutrition at Brooklyn College. All right, so I want to switch gears a little bit and talk more about what's going on in Puerto Rico outside of the food space. And, you know, throughout this year, and it's kind of been an ongoing thing over the last couple of years, but the debt crisis is in Europe. And I feel like they were getting a lot of attention, but closer to home, and I feel like getting less attention was the Puerto Rican debt crisis. So I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about where we are and how we got here from your understanding. And I know it's a little bit more of an economic conversation, but we'll try to keep it simple and just dive a little bit deeper into what's going on in the everyday lives of Puerto Ricans right now. So what's your understanding?
It is a complicated question, and to answer it properly, we'll have to go back to, you know, way back when, 1898, when the U.S. came to us. But it is, and a big piece of it is a political situation. And I should explain a little bit, because people typically don't understand how Puerto Rico fits in the political realm. So we are a territory of the U.S. Some people might argue a colony. Officially, we are a commonwealth. But if you know that Massachusetts is a commonwealth, that what does that mean? What it means in Puerto Rico is that, first of all, we cannot vote in U.S. elections. We don't have a vote for president. We have a resident commissioner in Washington that's technically a lobbyist. He doesn't have a vote that, if he votes and his vote changes anything, it doesn't count. So it's that level of lack of representation. What that means is that things that are applied at the federal level, for example, take the minimum wage, it is applied at the U.S. level and then immediately goes into Puerto Rico. And that, I mean, if we can, and there are people that are arguing right now that Puerto Rico should be exempted from that law to allow local commerce to be able to employ more people. Another piece of this that is not, even though it's getting more attention in the island, but I don't know how much here, are the cabotage laws that were enacted in Puerto Rico in the very early starts of our relationships with the U.S. And what that says is that we can only use U.S. flagged ships with U.S. People in the ship to ship food to and from. Anything that we, not only food, but anything else, has to come in a U.S. flagship. And those are the most expensive ones in the world. So what happens is that it increases the cost of everything. I'm going back to food. It increases the cost of food, and it also puts us at risk of food insecurity. Just to give you a recent example about that, if you heard of the El Faro ship that was lost in the last hurricane, mm-hmm. I forget the name of the hurricane, but it was just recently.
Joaquin, I think.
Yeah. Yes. That ship was coming from Jacksonville, Florida, to Puerto Rico with food. So it is at that level of complication. At the same time that we don't have a say on how to solve our issues on our economy, we unfortunately have a lot of public spending. The government is the main employer of the island, so that is a big part of it. With the modernization policies of the 1940s, we lost our agriculture, and agriculture can be a good source of income. And we have relied, I think, too long on trying to bring businesses to Puerto Rico, enticing them with tax exemptions. So one current example right now is that there is a recruitment campaign for billionaires in the U.S. to come to Puerto Rico without paying taxes on, I think, capital gains. Mm-hmm. I don't know maybe the entire details, but it's the idea of come to Puerto Rico, we're not going to tax you. And then their hope is that as these billionaires live in the island, that they will use the services, but there is so much income that you can get with those types of policies.
Hmm. And, you, okay, so
it was a lot.
No, that was an excellent insight to the situation there. And we could definitely spend all day talking about how there are opportunities there for big hedge funds and billionaires with super bonds and things like this, some of these solutions that are being floated out there. Let's try to stay away from some of that. I mean, the government has a debt crisis. They're saying about a $72.6 billion debt fall of a shortfall, I should say. And at the end of November, they're going to run out of money, and there's payments due on December 1. And unlike what we did with some of the industries and the big banks here in the U.S., there's no government bailout from the U.S. to Puerto Rico being offered. And because of that, Puerto Rico is basically just having to cut. There's all these austerity measures. So, I mean, you know, and taxes are going up, personal income taxes, sales taxes, insurance, you know, all of these things. How is that affecting everyday Puerto Ricans? Especially if the government's one of the number one employers on the island and they're having to cut programs, and I'm assuming that means jobs as well.
Yes. And I mean, you do have, people are not as, they might be fired from their jobs. There's unemployment in the island, and the price of everything is going up, especially with the taxes. People are being taxed. Services are being cut. Utilities are going up. So the cost of everything is going up. And what's happening is that, unfortunately, we do have an outflux of people leaving the island. And at the same time, if those people that are leaving are the ones that if they stay, they are paying taxes, using services. So it's this endless cycle that's happening. And for example, as people leave, there are less kids going to school, so they're closing schools and laying off teachers. So you do have this chain of events that go on and on.
Well, I know we talked about it before the show, and the Juan Gonzalez from Democracy Now! Gave a speech at NYU, and you can find it on Democracy Now!'s webpage. You can just look for Puerto Rican debt crisis, and he doesn't mince words. He says what's happening in Puerto Rico is a humanitarian crisis, and that it's a real opportunity. Of all the solutions that are being offered, maybe this is an opportunity to change the relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. So what are your thoughts on that? Going back, like you said, we have to go back to 1898 and really figure out how we got here. What about going forward?
That conversation about Puerto Rican status, it's a difficult one. And I think it's one that you have to solve. The way, for example, just basic things like the way politics work in the island, the main political parties are based on the status question. You have the pro-independent party that it's a very low percentage, and we can talk about the reasons why. You have the pro, but the main two are the pro-statehood and the Commonwealth. And people, I don't know how they'll deal with this, because the question is, if we vote to become a state, will the U.S. have us as a state? People say maybe not, because that has a bunch of different implications. Independence is the other option, but then after being a colony for so long and become very dependent, I mean, there's a host of reasons why that can be tricky. But there could be adjustments to the relationship. One thing that I know the Congress of Puerto Rico is asking is going back to the cabotage laws and trying to make an exemption for the island. So that could be ways of, if we're staying the way we are for now, as people decide what we want to do, just tweaking it a little bit more to make it more fair. Mm-hmm. Another conversation that is currently going on is with Medicare. And people are asking for the expansion of Medicare benefits to the island, because that would also help a lot with the health crisis that we have. Yeah. That's another one. Doctors are leaving.
Pension and health crisis is, and the education crisis. Mm-hmm. Those three, really, the trifecta of them in Puerto Rico is it's pretty dire, I would say, based on what I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's leave the debt crisis a little bit behind, but talk a little bit more about, specifically, we'll talk about water and agriculture. I read recently that water rates were increased by 67% across the island. And then this past summer, climate change happening everywhere, but it's specifically in Puerto Rico, the drought conditions have prompted water rationing periods. And I know recently there were 400,000 residents that can only get water every third day. And I know you were there this past summer or the spring, and you had some experience with that. So maybe you can tell us what's going on there.
Yes, the water was happening alongside the debt crisis.
It's, right, yeah. They compound each other. It's not
everything
a,
at the same
not
time.
Not good.
If being in Puerto Rico in the summer, it's very hot. So just thinking about not being able to shower properly for skipping those days is very difficult. But the water issue, it's, I don't know if it's so much of a lack of rain and climate change. I mean, that does play a part of it, but at the same time, it's an infrastructural issue. The I forget how you call it in English, the where the water is held.
Plumbing?
The dam.
Okay.
Is it? It is currently being, there's a lot of sediments that is preventing from the holding in of water. And that's also causing the lack of water because the infrastructure is not well maintained in place. Another thing has to be with the behavior of people. And people in Puerto Rico have water reserves in their homes. That's very typical. So a lot of people, where I was staying with family, and I forgot that there was a water crisis because when water comes back, people fill up their water tanks and you keep going in life as if nothing is happening. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a strong public campaign, for example, about, like you see in California, that they're trying to adjust the green spaces to more desert-type plants that can live without water so much. Mm-hmm. So people are still watering their plants. They're still cleaning their sidewalks. So there's no consciousness of behavior. Because when the water came back, even if it was for 2 hours at a time, you can be sure that people were doing everything at that time with the water and not really preserving the water.
And when you start talking about infrastructure and public campaigns, then again, you just come back to this idea of like having the funds to, you know, improve infrastructure or have these public service campaigns. So it all comes back to the money, I suppose.
Yeah.
I know you wanted to make a point about agriculture. So even though we have all these challenges occurring on the island, is there any good coming out of this?
Yes. And going back to what I was saying about the industrialization policies in the island, again, one thing that happened was the loss of agriculture. But one thing that as I go back to Puerto Rico at least 2 times a year, and maybe 5 years from now, or maybe a little bit more, people are going back to the land. People that have lost jobs are taking up land in the rural areas and going back to agriculture. There's a government impulse for more local production. For example, sugar. To produce sugar in the island to make rum. I mean, we can question that decision as to what type of food the government is pushing for production, but at least it's looking at food as another source of income, going back to the island. And you do see, for example, young people going back to school, to the university, to study agriculture and going into businesses, selling food, selling different local food stuff. So that has been, I think, a positive thing. And also that, I think, has also helped in that impulse with the new local restaurants that we're seeing.
Excellent. All right. Well, we are out of time. Dr. Fuster, thank you so much for joining me on Heritage Radio.
Thank you for having me.
And also a big thanks to our sponsor. That's all for Native this week. On next week's show, find out where Savor Magazine says the next big food spot in the world is. Savor will be in studio to tell us all about it, but you'll have to tune in to find out more. Be sure to check in here live Thursday morning at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.